have a fantastic bonus show for you today. Iowa and New Hampshire are not guaranteed to be the first primaries of 2024. We'll tell you what's going on and why. We will also talk about the extension to the federal travel mask mandate, which applies on planes and elsewhere. And lastly, Governor Greg Abbott of Texas doing quite a stunt with a bus of migrants going to Washington, D.C. We'll tell you what's going on and what they hope to get out of it. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Sign up.
WRCT, In Sound, from Way Out.
The pose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beat. Pittsburgh, right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM, word to your mother.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Was represented Raytheon, BAE, sorry, BAE Systems, Lockheed Martin, Huntington Ingalls, General Dynamics, and Northrop Grumman were all represented today.
As the Pentagon meets with the nation's largest weapons contractors, Russia's warned the Biden administration to stop arming Ukraine, claiming it's adding fuel to the conflict. This comes as a Russian warship sinks in the Black Sea, hours after Ukraine claimed to have attacked it with cruise missiles. We'll speak to William Hartung, then look at how the war is reverberating across the globe.
End this war. But this war will not end merely in Ukraine. The entire war must be ended. No more seeking to defeat near-peer rivals. This is the worst kind of macho idealism, the idea that the United States can be dominant forever.
We'll speak to Vijay Prashad. And as a judge orders the suspected New York subway gunman held without bail, we'll speak to Mother Jones editor Mark Fulman, author of the new book Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. All that and more coming up. Rush, welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russia's military says the flagship of its Black Sea fleet, the guided missile cruiser Moskva, which stands for Moscow, sank as it was being towed to port Thursday, forcing some 500 sailors to abandon ship. The loss of the Moskva was reported hours after Ukraine's military claimed it had successfully attacked the warship with cruise missiles. Russia contends the ship was damaged after a fire caused ammunition on board to explode. This comes as the Washington Post is reporting the Russian government has formally warned the Biden administration to stop arming Ukraine, claiming it's adding fuel to the conflict. Russia has warned the governments of Finland and Sweden against joining NATO, saying it's prepared to station more nuclear weapons in the Baltic Sea region in response to further NATO expansion. The threat came as CIA Director William Burns told lawmakers they should not discount the threat of Russia potentially using tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine out of desperation. We'll have more on the war in Ukraine after headlines. In occupied East Jerusalem, more than 150 people were injured after Israeli soldiers attacked Palestinian worshippers inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque shortly after morning prayers Friday. Witnesses said troops fired tear gas, rubber-coated bullets, concussion grenades into the holy site's prayer halls and courtyards.
They brutally emptied the compound. They were attacking the employees, normal people, elders, and young people. There were many people injured. They fired rubber bullets inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. They were beating everyone, even the paramedics.
One local hospital received 40 injured Palestinians, including two in critical condition. Israeli troops rounded up and arrested at least 300 people. The raid follows a series of attacks by Palestinians and Arab citizens of Israel that have killed people inside Israel since March 22nd. Meanwhile, Israeli raids on West Bank towns and villages have killed 29 Palestinians since March. Among the dead are a 34-year-old Palestinian lawyer who was shot in the chest Wednesday and a 14-year-old boy killed by Israeli troops who accused him of throwing a Molotov cocktail. Six United States senators have arrived in Taiwan for a surprise visit, prompting an angry response from China. The delegation says it's planning 2 days of talks on U.S.-Taiwan relations and regional security. New Jersey Democrat Bob Menendez, who chairs the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, spoke after he was welcomed by Taiwan's president.
With Taiwan producing 90% of the world's high-end semiconductor products, it is a country of global significance, of global consequence, of global impact, and therefore it should be understood that the security of Taiwan has a global impact for those who would wish it ill.
In response, China's military sent naval ships, bombers, and fighter planes to the East China Sea for war games. In a statement, the People's Liberation Army warned, quote, U.S. bad actions and tricks are completely futile and very dangerous. Those who play with fire will burn themselves, unquote. The British government's announced it could soon resettle some asylum seekers to Rwanda as an attempt to deter more people from attempting to reach Britain for refuge. Prime Minister Boris Johnson spoke Thursday.
This innovative approach, driven by our shared humanitarian impulse and made possible by Brexit freedoms, will provide safe and legal routes for asylum while disrupting the business model of the gangs.
Human rights groups condemned the plan as shockingly ill-conceived. Amnesty International UK said in a statement, quote, sending people to another country, let alone one with such a dismal human rights record, for asylum processing is the very height of irresponsibility and shows how far removed from humanity and reality the government now is on asylum issues, unquote. In Michigan, the family of Patrick LaLoya is demanding the white Grand Rapids police officer who killed the 26-year-old Congolese refugee be fired and charged with a crime. City officials have yet to name the officer who is seen on video pulling his service pistol from a holster and firing a fatal shot into LaLoya's head after a struggle. Patrick's father, Peter LaLoya, said through an interpreter he and his family had escaped war and persecution in the Democratic Republic of Congo only to see Patrick killed like an animal by Michigan police.
My heart is really deeply broken. I didn't believe that in this country,
genocide.
That there is a genocide in this country.
Sikukua najua.
I didn't know.
Sikukua najua kama hapa mwainchi.
I didn't know that here in America,
kunaweza kuwa execution ya mtu kwa kumuua.
There can be an execution style to kill someone.
Patrick LaLoya's family was standing next to their lawyer, Ben Crump. Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has signed a bill banning most abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. It's modeled after the Mississippi abortion law that the Supreme Court is currently weighing and which could essentially undo Roe v. Wade. In a statement, NARAL Pro-Choice America called Florida's abortion ban a, quote, shameless step towards what could be a terrifying new future for reproductive freedom in the country, unquote. A jury in Washington, D.C., has found an Ohio man guilty of felony obstruction of Congress after he joined the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. 38-year-old Dustin Thompson did not contest charges that he stole a bottle of whiskey and a coat rack from the Senate parliamentarian's office and ran from a police officer seeking to question him. Thompson's defense hinged on his claim that he was following presidential orders when he was swept up in the Capitol riot. He's the third January 6th insurrectionist to be found guilty by a jury. His conviction came as former senior Trump advisor Stephen Miller was questioned for 8 hours Thursday by the House committee investigating the January 6th attack. Miller reportedly refused to answer questions about his conversations with Trump, claiming executive privilege. The Republican National Committee has voted to withdraw from the Commission on Presidential Debates. Thursday's unanimous vote by the RNC came after numerous complaints by ex-President Trump over debate formats and the Commission's choice of moderators. The Commission was formed by the Democratic and Republican parties in 1987 and quickly took control of the debates from the nonpartisan League of Women Voters. The Commission has allowed just one third-party candidate, Ross Perot, to participate in presidential debates. A bipartisan group of over 100 Texas lawmakers have joined calls to stop the execution of Melissa Lucio, who is scheduled to die in less than 2 weeks. Lucio says she was wrongfully convicted of killing her 2-year-old daughter, Mariah, after a tragic accident in 2007. Attorneys say Lucio faced a lifetime of abuse, was pressured to make a false confession, and didn't get a fair trial. This week, lawmakers asked the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles to grant Lucio clemency after a hearing in which they called on the district attorney to cancel her April 27th execution date. Cameron County District Attorney Luis Sanz testified, if Lucio does not get a stay, quote, then I will do what I have to do to and stop it. Former trial juror Johnny Galvin also testified via his daughter that he opposed Lucio's execution.
The idea that my decision to take another person's life was not based on complete and accurate information in a fair trial is horrifying.
Lucio would be the first Latina woman executed by Texas. Next week, the state plans to execute 77-year-old Cora Wayne Bunchen, the oldest person on Texas death row. In labor news, workers at two El Milagro tortilla plants in Chicago have won wage increases and other victories after months of fighting for better working conditions. The tortilla manufacturer said it would end a seven-day work week, but workers are reporting El Milagro has yet to fulfill the demand to be closed on Sundays. El Milagro will now also provide anti-sexual harassment training for managers, air conditioning in the lunchrooms, and has promised to improve its sick day policy. But workers have vowed to keep organizing until the company prioritizes worker safety and respect and agrees to their other demands. And here in New York City, a coalition of union leaders and workers led a protest Thursday outside the $40 million penthouse of Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz, denouncing the corporation's ongoing retaliation and firing of workers trying to unionize. Among the speakers at the rally were Charles Jenkins, president of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, and Larry Holmes of the Workers' Assembly Against Racism.
We demand the right for not some workers to be unionized like me. But we demand all workers have a right to unionize.
All of your union busting, the Starbucks workers are just getting angrier. Just organizing more stores. And if you keep your union busting up, all you're gonna do is wake up a sleeping giant. The working class in this country.
Despite an aggressive union busting campaign by Starbucks, thousands of workers at some 220 shops have filed for union elections, including a Starbucks at Mall of America. A total of 22 Starbucks stores have successfully unionized across the country. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Russia's invasion in Ukraine is now in its 50th day. On Thursday, the most powerful Russian warship in its Black Sea fleet sank as it was being towed to port hours after Ukraine claimed to have attacked the warship with cruise missiles. Russia denies this and said the ship was damaged after a fire caused ammunition on board to explode. This comes as the Washington Post is reporting the Russian government has formally warned the Biden administration to stop arming Ukraine, claiming it's adding fuel to the conflict. In a diplomatic note dated Tuesday, Russia also accused NATO of pushing Ukraine to, quote, abandon talks with Russia, quote, in order to continue the bloodshed, unquote. The note was sent on the same day news broke of the Biden administration's plans to send a new $800 million arms transfer to Ukraine that includes armored Humvees, coastal defense drones, howitzers, and weapons training. This is Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby.
The United States has now committed more than $3.2 billion in security assistance to Ukraine since the beginning of the Biden administration, including approximately $2.6 billion since the beginning, just since the beginning of their unprovoked invasion on February 24th.
On Wednesday, Pentagon officials held an extraordinary meeting with eight top weapons contractors. But the Pentagon attempted to downplay the significance of the meeting.
It was part of a normal, scheduled, routine conversation that we have with defense industry leaders, but obviously focused much more specifically on what's going on in Ukraine. So Boeing was represented, L3 Harris was represented, Raytheon, BAE Systems, Lockheed Martin, Huntington Ingalls, General Dynamics, and Northrop Grumman were all represented today.
Ukrainian officials have also been meeting directly with U.S. weapons manufacturers, this according to the Washington Post, which reports the Ukrainian ambassador to the U.S. met last week with General Atomics, a leading drone manufacturer. We're joined now by William Hartung, national security and foreign policy expert at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. His latest book, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Bill, if you can start off by responding to this meeting that Kirby calls just run-of-the-mill, but the level of involvement of the weapons manufacturers right now in the war in Ukraine.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's routine in the sense that it's the military-industrial complex in action, but it's extraordinary in the sense that it was very specifically to coordinate how to arm Ukraine and how these companies would profit from it. So the Pentagon has been giving missiles, anti-tank, anti-air missiles, and other equipment through its existing stocks that it already has, and then it's going to pay these companies to replenish those stocks. And so the discussion was, how quickly can you crank out these weapons? Do you need new production lines? Do you need more money to make it happen more quickly? So it was really in part about how best these companies could profit from the war. And they've been posturing as if they're some sort of bastions of promoting democracy because they're arming Ukraine. But of course, they're also sending weapons to Yemen that are being used to bomb school buses and civilians, killing thousands of people. So really, they'll sell to anybody with the money, but they're using the Ukraine crisis to sort of try to remold their image.
And Bill, could you talk about the relative size we're talking about here? This is about now about more than $3 billion from the Biden administration to Ukraine in terms of the context of what this means. To these companies, this increased amount of money, not only now, but clearly there'll be security needs for years and maybe decades into the future.
Well, this is a bonanza for the companies. You know, they're going to profit from this in so many ways, it makes my head spin. But you've got the $3 billion in direct arms, which is a substantial amount for these companies. Then you've got countries like Germany increasing their Pentagon military budgets to buy things like Lockheed Martin F-35s for billions of dollars, Poland buying General Dynamics tanks. And then you've got several flows of money. There's a Pentagon program to arm Ukraine. There's a State Department aid program to help arm Ukraine. And then, of course, there's the Pentagon budget. And these companies and the Pentagon are arguing that Ukraine is a reason to push it to record levels, over $800 billion in the Biden proposal, which is $100 billion more than at the peak of the Cold War. So between the arms to Ukraine, arming the European buildup, the Pentagon being jacked up far beyond what is needed even to address the Ukraine crisis, these companies, which already get the top five get $150 billion a year from the Pentagon, that's just going to go up and up. So this is kind of unfortunate for the world, but it's good financial news for these companies.
And you've talked about, for instance, Lockheed Martin in fiscal year 2020 alone received $75 billion. That's more than the entire budget of the State Department. So much for the emphasis of the Biden administration on diplomacy, isn't it?
Well, exactly. I mean, it's just so stunning that one company could get more Pentagon contracts than the entire State Department, especially for an administration that said their policy was going to be diplomacy first. So it's just a sense of how our budget is still very much skewed towards a militarized foreign policy at a time when I think diplomacy is more urgent than ever.
Raytheon CEO Greg Hayes defended how the Ukraine war has boosted their profits during an interview last month with the Harvard Business Review. This is what he said.
I make no apology for that. I think, again, recognizing, we are there to defend democracy. And the fact is, eventually, we will see some benefit in the business over time. Everything that's being shipped into Ukraine today, of course, is coming out of stockpiles, either at DOD or from our NATO allies. And that's all great news. Eventually, we'll have to replenish it, and we will see a benefit to the business over the next coming years.
So that's Raytheon CEO Greg Hayes. If you can talk about the significance of that comment, and also NATO expansion once again, with Finland and Sweden now talking about joining, what that means, and what weapons manufacturers have to do with NATO and the deals that are made, what is required of countries when they join NATO?
Well, yes. I mean, I think, the Raytheon CEO, that is a stunning statement. It's sort of the height of hypocrisy to say their role is to defend democracy. I mean, if arms sales are to defend democracy, U.S. contractors should stop arming Saudi Arabia, the UAE. There's a recent deal to Nigeria, fighter sale to Egypt, firearms to the Philippines. All these countries that are major human rights abusers using U.S. weapons either to suppress their own citizens or in reckless, devastating wars like in Yemen. If that's really what the industry is about, they should refrain from those sales. So it has nothing to do with defending democracy, everything to do with padding their bottom lines. As for NATO expansion, NATO has a goal of 2% of gross domestic product to be spent on their militaries. About a third of NATO countries meet that, but Germany is going to push up to that level, spend another probably at least $50 billion a year. And they've already said they want to buy Lockheed Martin F-35s. Finland, even before joining NATO, made a $9 billion deal to buy F-35s from Lockheed Martin. Sweden has its own weapons industry, may buy a little less from the U.S., but the whole push for more spending by NATO will be a huge boon to U.S. Weapons contractors. And, of course, we can't forget that back when NATO was expanded, companies like Lockheed Martin lobbied heavily to see that happen because they knew that the new joining countries would have to get rid of Soviet-era weapons and buy U.S. and European systems so they could operate alongside NATO allies. So there's been a long history of U.S. companies cashing in on the whole NATO arrangement.
And, Bill, I wanted to ask you, there were two major powers in the world that were effectively disarmed after World War II, Germany and Japan. And they've pretty much remained disarmed for all these decades. What is this conflict doing? You've written about the situation in Japan that's not between Japan and Russia that hasn't gotten much attention. Could you talk about that as well?
Well, I think between the focus on China, which the Pentagon still calls their, quote, pacing threat, and the attempt to exploit the Ukraine crisis to further push up the Pentagon budget, but also to get allies like Germany and Japan to spend more. You have the situation where the countries that were disarmed in World War II, that were the aggressor nations, have now transformed into U.S. allies and now are remilitarizing. And so there's a danger that even if the U.S. were to take a more sensible policy in terms of balancing diplomacy, not having a sort of military-first approach to Russia and China, that other countries might take up that course or that approach. And so there is a danger in kind of this generalized militarization of not only the U.S., but also its allies.
And finally, Bill Hartung, just very quickly, the revolving door with the Biden administration, which we've seen with Republican and Democratic administrations as high up as Lloyd Austin, right? He was formerly on the board of Raytheon. These weapons manufacturers have total access to these government officials.
Yes. Well, this is sort of business as usual, but it hasn't changed under Biden. The GAO said 1,700 people have gone from the Pentagon to the contractors to lobby for them. And then you have people like Secretary Austin coming from the companies to the Pentagon. So you've got this very tight relationship where often the contractors and the government officials that are supposed to be regulating them are actually almost partners with them in promoting higher spending and more contracts for those companies.
William Hartung, I want to thank you for being with us, national security and foreign policy expert at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. His latest book, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. When we come back, Vijay Prashad joins us about how the war is reverberating across the globe. Stay with us. Mm-hmm. Start Running by The Comet Is Coming. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The head of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, warned Thursday that Russia's invasion of Ukraine will lead to more hunger and social unrest across the globe. The IMF managing director, Kristalina Georgieva, spoke in Washington.
In the past 7 weeks, the world has experienced a second major crisis, a war on top of a pandemic. This risks eroding much of the progress we have made over the past 2 years, climbing back from COVID. Add to this the growing threat of fragmentation into geopolitical and economic blocs. In a world where war in Europe creates hunger in Africa, where a pandemic can circle the globe in days and reverberate for years, where emissions anywhere means rising sea levels everywhere, the threat to our collective prosperity from a breakdown in global cooperation cannot be overstated. The root cause of what we face today is the war. And it is the war that must end.
IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva speaking Thursday. To talk more about how the war in Ukraine is reverberating around the world, we're joined by Vijay Prashad, director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research and chief correspondent of Globetrotters. He's the author of many books, including The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South, and Washington Bullets, A History of the CIA, Coups and Assassinations. Vijay Prashad is joining us from Santiago, Chile. Welcome to Democracy Now! Vijay, if you can talk about how Russia's war on Ukraine is reverberating across the globe.
First, Amy, Happy New Year. It's Happy New Year in my birth area of Bengal today. It's an interesting period to commemorate the end of a year, which one thought would bring us, as the head of the IMF said, out of the pandemic. And instead, of course, it's brought us into war and sanctions. I want to remind people that a decade ago, when there was a drought in Ukraine and in Russia, where about 25% of the world's wheat is exported into, when there was that drought in 2010, there was a major uprising, not only in the Arab world, which we call the Arab Spring, but across the African continent, now long forgotten, I think. It's important to remember that when there's a crisis in food, and when food prices go up, the political crisis is almost immediate. There's already been an economic crisis in Sri Lanka that's metastasized into a political crisis. We've seen the government fall in Pakistan. Around the world, we see food price inflation creates serious problems for governments. Before this war and the sanctions against Russia, 2.7 billion people struggled with hunger. It's likely that we'll go above 3 billion before the month is over. We're also going to see, I think, catastrophic problems with disruptions in fuel distribution. But I want to say one thing about this, Amy, that, you know, it looks, when you watch the news, perhaps in the West, it looks like a world of certainty. Everybody seems clear about what's happening. In the rest of the world, I think people are really trying to breathe in the contradictions. They understand that this is a ghastly war, but there have been ghastly wars before this. I think there's some perplexity about why this war is treated as so different than other wars. I think in the contradictions, countries are not willing to break ties with Russia or to cut the import of grain and fuel from places like Russia. They have their own populations to take care of, and they have to consider their needs and their desires.
And Vijay, I wanted to ask you, it's not only the governments of many of these countries that are not buying into the call for sanctions on Russia, but some of the public opinion polling has shown that in many countries, in Indonesia, in Brazil, in South Africa, in many countries in the global south, the public has a different opinion about this war as well.
Well, there's no question that this is a terrible war. I mean, like all wars, this is brutal, this is nasty, and so on. But let's take an example. There was an appalling bombing of the maternity hospital in Mariupol. Immediately thereafter, the U.S. government talked about war crimes. The International Criminal Court was suborned to say that this is going to have a file open, you know, for war crimes personally against Mr. Putin and so on. But have we forgotten the Amaria shelter, 1,500 civilians killed in 1991 when the United States bombed a shelter, knowing full well there were civilians there? No question of any interrogation of war crimes. The language of war crimes was not used. In Libya, after NATO quite ruthlessly bombed that country, Peter Olson of NATO, the lead attorney, said openly, look, NATO can't commit war crimes. War crimes are committed by other people, not by NATO. I mean, just this recent month, there were Israeli airstrikes which struck the Ramal Medical Center. Two doctors killed. Do we know their names? Ayman Abu Al-Auf and Moen Alolu. I mean, they were killed in the middle of all this, but there was no question of calling the Israeli strikes war crimes. So this kind of open, rank hypocrisy, I think, is what is striking lots of people around the world. I have to say, Juan, that, you know, I made a speech in Glasgow where I questioned the colonial mentality of the West regarding climate policy. That speech has been viewed by hundreds of millions of people on WhatsApp groups all around the world, including by right-wing WhatsApp groups in India. People are frustrated with the kind of colonial way in which the Western powers and the Western media reports things. The very fact that you know the flag coloring of Ukraine, but have no idea what the flag of Yemen looks like, what the flag of Palestine looks like, what the flag of the Congo looks like, and needless to say, what the flag of Iraq looks like. I mean, that has frustrated a lot of people and is driving public opinion.
And what's your reaction to the President Biden's recent meeting with President Modi on Monday?
It's very interesting. You know, it's not just Biden. The U.S. State Department sent a high official. The British Foreign Ministry sent their leading cabinet minister, the Foreign Secretary Liz Truss. They all went to India to say, look, how is it possible that India, governed by a right-wing country led by Narendra Modi, a subordinate ally of the United States, a member of the Quad, how is it that India is not willing to come out there and attack the Russian war in Ukraine? How is it that India is not willing to condemn Vladimir Putin and so on? This is a full court press. And inside India, there's been a great deal of frustration. There's questions raised about the so-called finger wagging at India for India's policy. I think that what people need to understand, this is not just India. I mean, India has been, I suppose, the most forthright in refusing to come out there and condemn this war. It's not just India. Look at Germany. Germany continues to buy energy from Russia. The German chancellor directly told Mr. Biden that, look, if Germany breaks ties with Russia, bans natural gas imports, Germany will plunge into a terrible recession. The Japanese prime minister has also told the United States and told the Russians directly, look, we're quite happy to sign on to the G7 statement condemning Russia and its war, but we're not going to cut ties. We're not going to stop importing liquefied natural gas from Sakhalin 2. We're not going to stop importing crude oil. And furthermore, Japan is one of the major investors in Sakhalin 2 and Sakhalin 1. These are very large and important energy projects of the Russian people, Russian government, but also private sector. And it's the Japanese state that has invested in them. It's not willing to cut all that. So the United States, I think, is coming to realize, or I hope it comes to realize, that many countries, not only so-called adversarial countries, but also countries that are closely allied, like Germany, Japan, India, and so on, are just not willing to break ties. And just let me say one thing about that. You know, for 30 plus years, the U.S. government pushed
a globalization agenda which integrated countries with each other. Russia was at the core of that integration, not only for the export of fuel, but also for the export of the wealth stolen from the state of the USSR after it collapsed. All that money taken by billionaires was invested in international financial markets, and having integrated the world, now suddenly, as the head of the IMF pointed out, suddenly two major shocks take place, the pandemic and then the war and the sanctions. And these two shocks have not been shocks merely to people's household budgets and so on, but they've been shocks to the level of integration of the world economy. And it's very hard for countries to disentangle on a dime. Just because the U.S. White House says break ties, it's not easy to break ties. It's not a question of political connections. This is a question of deep structural economic relations which cannot be broken. If they break, it will plunge these countries into even greater catastrophe.
During a news conference Monday, India's External Affairs Minister S. Jaishankar pointed out Europe buys far more Russian oil and gas than India. This is what he said.
If you are looking at energy purchases from Russia, I would suggest that your attention should be focused on Europe, which probably we do buy some energy, which is necessary for our energy security. But I suspect, looking at the figures, probably our total purchases for the month would be less than what Europe does in an afternoon. So you might want to think about it.
So, Vijay Prashad, you can comment on that. But also, as you talk about the rank hypocrisy, I mean, you have not only the United States, but Europe talking about Putin's war crimes. Where would he be tried? A logical forum would be the International Criminal Court. Neither the United States nor Russia nor Ukraine, for that matter, has fully signed on to the International Court. It is pointed out over and over again, anti-personnel landmines, just brutal, focused on killing people that Russia is using in Ukraine. The U.S. hasn't signed on to the anti-landmine treaty that, for example, Princess Di had so campaigned for. So you have all these international treaties that the United States has not respected, and yet at this point is really invoking the foundation of them to hold Putin accountable. So talking about, as you talk about the rank hypocrisy, do you also criticize, though, Putin for invading Ukraine?
Of course, I criticize Putin for invading Ukraine, Amy. That goes without saying, because he has violated the UN Charter. It is a brutal war, as I said when I first started speaking, but I think that's hardly the question whether I condemn Mr. Putin or not. The issue is that we're living in a world where, for a lot of people, it looks like it's an upside-down world. It's not just the question of the treaties you mentioned. The United States government has not signed the international laws of the seas, and yet it prosecutes so-called freedom of navigation missions against not only China in the South China Sea, using this UN Charter, which it's not a signatory of, but it has been provoking clashes with Russia in the Black Sea, in the Baltic Sea, and in the Arctic Sea, again, using these so-called freedom of navigation missions. Let's take the question of the International Criminal Court. When Special Prosecutor Fatih Bensouda opened a file to investigate war crimes in Afghanistan, and by the way, she was really clear. She said war crimes conducted by everybody, by the Taliban, by the Afghan National Army, by the United States, by other NATO countries, and so on. When she did that, the United States government threatened her, told her that neither she nor her family would ever get a visa to come to the United States, and so on. The U.S. put enormous pressure on the International Criminal Court to shut down that investigation. That's incredible. This is an investigation of war crimes which are detailed in the U.S. government's own documents, which had been released by the WikiLeaks Foundation, whose founder, Julian Assange, is sitting in Belmarsh prison, is being treated as a criminal, whereas the war criminals in Afghanistan are going free and threatening with mafia-like tactics the special prosecutor at the ICC. Meanwhile, again, in an afternoon, to quote the Indian high official, in an afternoon, the United States is able to get these bodies established by international law, which the United States is not a signatory to. The U.S. in an afternoon is able to get them to open a file and start talking about war crimes. Over a million people killed in Iraq and no investigation of war crimes. None. Over a million people. Half a million children killed in Iraq during the 1919 sanctions regime. Not even the word genocide. The West is walking all over the word genocide, is reducing the power of an important category, of an important convention, the 1951 Convention Against Genocide. This extraordinary casual and weaponization of human rights and the word genocide by the West is going to be something that we are going to face in the times ahead, when other countries are going to say, well, we can do anything if we are backed by Washington, D.C. This is extraordinarily perilous, and I hope people open their eyes to the very cynical way in which Washington, D.C. is approaching this terrible war taking place in Ukraine, a war that has to end with a ceasefire and negotiations. And you're not going to easily get a ceasefire and negotiations if you're going to loosely, as Mr. Biden did in Poland at Warsaw Castle, loosely call for regime change in Russia. That is not going to help you bring people to the table, whether it's in Belarus or it's in Antalya, Turkey. It's not going to bring Ukraine and Russia to the table. It's not going to stop Russia's war. If the Russians think that the United States has a total agenda to annihilate the Russian government, I'm afraid then you're not going to get a ceasefire. You're going to just get more atrocities in Ukraine, and that's something that the people of the world should not stand for.
And Vijay, I wanted to ask you, while this is continuing to play out, this war in Europe, the role of China, and of course, as you mentioned earlier, the United States has identified China as its long-term strategic foe. Could you talk about what this means about the relationship of these empires and China's role in the world?
Well, let's be frank, Juan. In 2018, the Trump administration announced that the war on terror was over and that the full force of the United States government was now going to be to prevent Russia and China. They actually mentioned both countries, Russia and China, what then Defense Secretary Jim Mattis called near-peer competitors. These near-peer competitors had to be prevented from rising. That was the U.S. doctrine, has not been pulled back by the Biden administration. That very year, the United States government unilaterally walked out of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, the INF Treaty. Mr. Putin and the Chinese government have said that they fear the placement of mid-level, these intermediate nuclear missiles near the Russian and Chinese border. This meant that they feared that there'd be these missiles placed in Ukraine or in Taiwan and so on. You've got to see it a little bit from their point of view. So they see this as extremely threatening to their existence, and they will do anything to prevent the placement of these kind of weapons near their territories. I think this is how the Chinese are seeing it. As far as I've been able to see, the Chinese have neither condemned the war nor applauded it. They would like this war to end. As I said earlier, China's economy is fundamentally integrated into the world economy. The last thing they want to see, and I actually agree on this point, the last thing we would like to see is a divided world, an iron curtain fall around Eurasia. Nobody should be actually pleased about that prospect. We want to see a more integrated world, a world of, let's say, you know, where there's a future before us, where we can tackle questions of climate change, we can tackle questions of social toxicity, we can tackle questions of militarism. These things cannot be dealt with if we have an iron curtain fall from the South China Sea to the Baltic Sea. That would be a nightmare for the planet, particularly now when the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has sounded the red alert regarding the climate catastrophe.
Very quickly, Vijay, on Thursday, the CIA director, William Burns, spoke at Georgia Tech, publicly discussed fears Russia could turn to using nuclear weapons out of desperation.
Given the potential desperation of President Putin and the Russian leadership, given the setbacks that they've faced so far militarily, none of us can take lightly the threat posed by a potential resort to tactical nuclear weapons or low-yield nuclear weapons. We don't. While we've seen some rhetorical posturing on the part of the Kremlin about moving to higher nuclear alert levels, so far we haven't seen a lot of practical evidence of the kind of deployments or, military dispositions that would, reinforce that concern.
Now, William Burns is an interesting figure, the CIA director, because he's the one who has warned for years, among many others, including progressive peace activists, against NATO moving eastward, saying it will provoke Russia. If you can end by talking about what this becoming, this kind of conflagration, a nuclear conflagration, and what you see as the outline of a ceasefire could be.
Well, Amy, the first thing I'd say is the question of NATO moving eastward is not the primary issue, because after all, in 2004, Sergei Lavrov, who continues to be the foreign minister, and Mr. Putin, who was even then the president, welcomed the Baltic states and other countries joining NATO. They joined NATO in 2004. The question is not NATO by itself. The question is a sense of security. I mean, what Mr. Burns could have said is that the United States pledges to return to arms control talks. I mean, having gutted the anti-ballistic missile treaty in 2002 unilaterally, that was the Bush administration, and then in 2018, the Trump administration unilaterally walking out of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, why doesn't the United States come to the table, as the Russians have been asking since 2018, and open a new arms control conversation? That seems to be a mature issue. Look, frankly, this ceasefire that takes place in Ukraine could take place in Ukraine in an afternoon, I think. The issue isn't Ukraine alone. It's the question of the U.S., the question of China, Russia. All of them need to come to a table. They need to discuss a new arms control regime. We don't have one. The world right now has nuclear weapons on hair trigger alerts without a proper arms control regime. That, to me, Amy, is terrifying. That needs to be on the table. To talk about a ceasefire in Ukraine, of course, that's got to be there, just as we talk about justice for the Palestinians and so on. But we've also got to recognize we're living right now without an arms control regime, without deterrence. And that really is terrifying.
Vijay Prashad, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll link to your articles. Director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. Coming up, Mother Jones editor Mark Fulman. He's author of the new book, Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. Back in 30 seconds. Jali by the Ukrainian singer Jamala. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Here in New York, a federal judge has ordered the suspected subway gunman held without bail as the city and much of the United States reels from an epidemic of mass shootings in trains, schools, and other public places. We spend the rest of the hour with Mark Fulman, national affairs editor at Mother Jones, where he covers gun violence and runs a mass shootings database. He has a new piece headlined Horror on the NYC Subway and How to Prevent the Next Attack, that draws on insights from his new book just out, Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. Mark, welcome back to Democracy Now! Let's just talk about that article that you just wrote. Looking at this shooting and the alleged shooter in New York, how to prevent these mass shootings.
Well, one of the things that was immediately clear in the case of the subway attack was that this was an attack that was planned over a period of time. We could see that with immediate evidence that was found by investigators that the perpetrator had gone in, accessorized in a certain kind of gear and outfit, that he had used smoke grenades and then opened fire. And this is really important because we have several big myths about mass shooters that we constantly repeat when these attacks happen, and they're unhelpful to really understanding the problem. I write about this at length in my new book, Trigger Points, that mass shooters don't just suddenly snap. These are not impulsive crimes. These are crimes that are planned over a period of time that develop, and there's often in almost every case, a robust trail of behavioral warning signs. And so with that, there is also opportunity to potentially step in and intervene and prevent these attacks from happening.
And how in this particular case, for example, from what you know, what might have been done to be able to apprehend this shooter before he actually took action?
Yeah, this case would be, I think, a particularly challenging one. We're still learning the details of it, so I want to be a little bit careful about analyzing it from that perspective. But over time, I suspect we will find out more and more about the warning signs that were present with this individual, who apparently was living in pretty significant isolation. But certainly his ability to access a firearm is a major question here, because we already know that he had a long criminal history and was still able to purchase a gun legally. This is a chronic problem in our country with the regulation of firearms or lack thereof. Beyond that, there was quite a bit of content that this perpetrator had posted on social media, videos he recorded ranting about various grievances and political ideology and hatred and anger, and in which, you know, there were quite a few signals that he was interested in and perhaps planning violence. And this is present in a lot of mass shooting cases. So the question then is, how do you detect that? Well, there are often people around perpetrators who see things like this, who get a sense of these threatening communications and feel unsettled by it. We've seen comments in the press since the attack of people who were neighbors who found him to be kind of a disturbing and upsetting guy. Again, I think this is a tough case because this person was apparently living in a pretty isolated set of circumstances before the attack. But many of these cases occur with perpetrators who are in workplaces or in schools. And in those cases, it's even more stark, the evidence when you go back and look at the cases, that there were people around the perpetrator who had a sense of something being wrong. And when people speak up in that situation and reach out for help, if there is a protocol in place with a method called threat assessment that is the focus of my book, Trigger Points, a team can do a lot to step in and evaluate if a person is becoming dangerous, if a person is planning violence, and then try to intervene in some constructive ways, ideally, to help that person onto a different path.
And I wanted to ask you the deeper question. I mean, we've confronted so many of these incidents of mass shootings over the decades now. What is it in American society that doesn't, where the officials and government don't act in a more forceful way to prevent these mass shootings? I mean, is it just the gun lobby, or is there something deeper in our society that basically accepts a culture of violence or feels powerless to be able to do anything about it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's a big question, and it's challenging to answer. Certainly, the political deadlock that we have in the country is an enormous problem, and we've watched it go on and on for years. There's a remarkable disconnect, in my view, between what the majority of the American public wants about in terms of gun regulations and gun violence, that we know from consistent polling over three decades now, showing that the majority of the country, including conservatives and gun owners, wants more effective gun regulations, better background checks, and other policies. So the political disconnect is one part of the answer, and I think the power of the gun lobby, as you note. Beyond that, I think there are some interesting broader cultural questions that we face. Why is it that this kind of violence is in some ways so accepted in our country? There's a kind of a broad sense of resignation, I think, that there isn't a whole lot we can do about it. I think that there is, you know, the sense that we're a violent society inherently, that sort of these ways of thinking about the problem and talking about it, I think, validates it in certain ways, that in some ways is unhelpful and perpetuates the problem. And this is part of what led me to write this book, because when I learned about this prevention method, behavioral threat assessment, I saw quite a lot of promise in it in terms of its focus on getting out front of the problem, not just thinking about, you know, arguing about gun policy, which is very important and is a battle that will continue. But, you know, in my view, can't be the only way that we approach this problem. This is a big, sprawling problem. It's complex, and it requires a broader set of solutions. And so by focusing more on community-based violence prevention work that is ideally constructive and gets in the way of the problem is potentially very helpful to our prospects of doing better on this.
Mark, we're going to do part two of this conversation and post it at democracynow.org. But very quickly, if we can use the Oxford High School massacre as an example, it is hard to believe that happened less than 2 months ago, February 22nd, when Ethan Crumbly opened fire, killing four students and injuring many others. Now his parents also being held accountable. Could we end with that and how you think that's a perfect example of a mass shooting that could have been prevented?
Yeah, the Oxford High School mass shooting is a particularly stark case in terms of what I'm talking about. The circumstances of it, you know, even for me as someone who's studied these cases for a decade now, quite astonishing in some ways in terms of the trail of warning signs and the number of people around the perpetrator who had a sense that he might commit this act of violence, including the parents. I mean, the alleged role of the parents is really quite shocking in some ways, in their apparent negligence of the deteriorating situation with their son and his trajectory toward violence. Appeared to even enable him by purchasing a firearm and ignoring warnings from the school. There are big questions about what the school did as well in terms of the warning signs being seen there. There were teachers who had become very alarmed about that student and had, referred him to counselors. The counselors were so concerned that they demanded that the parents remove the student from the school the morning before he attacked. And so this was a case where if there were a threat assessment program in place and trained experts who had the ability to see better what was going on here in terms of warning signs, there would have been very different action taken, in my view. There's no way that that student would have been returned to the classroom. So even when you go beyond the disturbing questions of his access as a 15-year-old to a handgun, there's also the question of why was the situation so ignored in some ways.
And we're going to talk more about that in the second part of our conversation. Mark Fulman, author of the new book, Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America, national affairs editor at Mother Jones, where he covers gun violence and runs their mass shootings database, which we're going to talk about. Democracy Now! Has an immediate job opening for a news writer producer. Visit democracynow.org/jobs to find out more and apply immediately. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
If a natural disaster comes knocking, how prepared is your family? You can't just close the door on earthquakes, floods, or hurricanes and hope they go away. That's why it's important to make a plan now. Ready.gov/plan has the tools and tips you need to prepare your family for an emergency. So if disaster shows up at your doorstep, you'll be ready. Visit ready.gov/plan and make a plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
You are listening to Viva Lamarck on WRCC Pittsburgh.
AIX Morning News Update. Mark's promise to rewrite rock history was prematurely and tragically interrupted last night when an overwhelming power surge totally destroyed Carnegie Hall and blacked out the entire city. Survivors describe the destruction as evil, spooky, and wow, bad karma, man. Our cameras are on the scene.
My name is Mark Mansabar. I know you love the thing you've got. You've never seen the likes of me. Why, I'm the biggest thing since World War III, girls. My name is Mark, I'm on fire. I'm the match, I'm the pyre. I'm the voodoo black musician priest. Why, I'm the greatest thing since World War III, girls.
You think he's acting, but he's not. His name is Mark, thanks a lot.
My name is Mark, thanks a lot. I'm the power Solomon used on lot. I am the poor, I am the snake, I'm the beat that makes you shake. I am the killer, I am the source, and you will worship me, of course. I'm the oracle, I'm the seer, the wit, there is no question that I am it. Hey girl,
thanks a lot. He looks so cool, but he's hot.
My name is Mark, thanks a lot. My name is Mark, thanks a lot. My name is Mark, thanks a lot. My
name is Mark, thanks a lot. Hey kids, it's time for Uncle Mark's cartoon show.
There was one room in her house that was always kept locked. It was the garage.